ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, three adults and a five-year-old girl vanished from Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and dark secrets.
Yep, because we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4.
I was starting to think this is not going to end well.
Subscribe to Expanse wherever you get your podcasts.
Her eyes are a bit glazed over, and she occasionally makes a very strange face. To the people assessing her, she's absolutely insane.
And all the doctors sign off that she's mad. They put her on the little boat that takes her, you know, ferries her across to Blackwell's Island, and she is admitted.
It's 1887, and Blackwell's Island? That is where New York City would send its most disturbed people.
There were prisons, almshouses, the insane asylums. I mean, every, you know, just the detritus of civilization was plopped on this island to kind of keep it out of Manhattan. And that is where she sought to go.
But there's something about this woman that the doctors didn't diagnose. And that is that she's faking it. She is a completely healthy woman heading into what they used to call, at least, an insane asylum. And she's doing it on a mission.
It's just a great device for really seeing what is going on.
10 days after this moment, this woman would emerge as a celebrity with a legacy that would last centuries.
Board games, hats, lamps. I mean, you just can't imagine the things that are named after her in this period. Like a movie star, which for a journalist is really weird.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of a brazen infiltration of a broken system that sparked a groundswell of change, inspired generations, and turned Nellie Bly into a household name. And no one saw it coming.
As a girl of 10, I read a juvenile biography of Nellie Bly and George Washington Carver and Florence Nightingale and all these characters of American history. And this would have been like 1950-something. And so the notion that I could have a career that was exciting as journalism, that her life portrayed in the most remarkable way, that was something I was going to do.
So this voice here, this is Brooke Kroger.
I'm an author, a journalist, a retired professor from NYU, and have spent my career looking to a large extent at journalism and its extensions.
So before we have Nellie Bly Girl Reporter, there's a different name. So let's start with that original name, Elizabeth Cochran. Who is Elizabeth Cochran as a child? What kind of life does she have?
She's called Pink in her family. Most girls dressed in brown, but her mother tarted her up in pink. She was the 13th of 15 children of Michael Cochran, who was a mill owner and judge in a very small hamlet in western Pennsylvania. And sadly, when Nellie was 6 or 7, her father died. And it's not that he left them penniless, but an estate divided among a widow and 15 children is not going to go so far.
What were the prospects for a young girl like her? What were the expectations on American society at the time about what the best she could hope for from her life?
To marry, and probably not so well because there was no dowry. So her prospects were limited. I mean, the family had a sense of itself as, you know, American noble. He was a judge, he was the postmaster, he owned a mill, and then suddenly there was just nothing. But they had a sense of themselves as having position in society, even though they really had fallen on very hard times. The prospects were terrible.
The odds are stacked against young Elizabeth. At 15, she's enrolled in school, but only lasted a term because the money ran dry. So she looked for work to help support the family and then also had very little luck. Now, here's the interesting part. She compared her lack of job offers to her brothers. And let's be clear here. She saw her brothers as dumb compared to her, but they were getting jobs while she wasn't. And that seed of inequality between the genders was sown. Fast forward a few years, and she's reading this article in the Pittsburgh Dispatch that criticizes the presence of women in the workforce.
An opinion column by a very famous, Pittsburgh famous anyway, correspondent named Erasmus Wilson, known as QO, the Quiet Observer. And he writes a whole column, a screed, about what are women good for and why are they entering the workforce and getting in our way. And she responds with venom. I mean, she is furious at this because, of course, she's a young woman who's having to help support her family. So this isn't women, you know, dallying. This is really necessity.
So she writes this fiery letter to the editor under the pen name of Lonely Orphan Girl.
And she has terrible grammar, she has terrible punctuation, but there's a spirit in the letter. And in a most remarkable journalistic moment in all time, the editor says, "I'm going to ignore all that, but I see a spirit here." And he runs an ad in the paper asking Lonely Orphan Girl to come forward.
Elizabeth meets the editor and he hires her on the spot and he gives her a new pen name. One that would stick. Nellie Bly.
Came from a popular Stephen Foster song. Nellie Bly, bring the broom along. Da da da. You know, anyway, it's like that.
Sounds like a banger. Anyways, Nellie, as she's now known, is working at the Pittsburgh Dispatch newspaper and she wants to write real journalism, articles exposing corruption and mistreatment. But whenever she tries to report on it, it just falls flat.
I don't know this for a fact, but I believe this is how the idea came to think about undercover reporting, that how are you going to get real information without the management, you know, interfering with your objectives?
So Nellie decides that a change of scenery might help. She leaves Pittsburgh, starts writing reports from various places, including Mexico, before she eventually lands in New York. Now, she is still writing as a correspondent for the Pittsburgh Dispatch, but she's trying to get in front of New York editors to see if she can get a new job. However,
nobody's letting her in the door. She makes friends with another columnist, and he gives her the idea to ask to interview all the men editors of New York about how they feel about women in journalism, which was a pretty clever idea, and it gets her in the door to do these interviews. The story, of course, if you're a woman reading it, are shocking. I mean, the attitudes were just horrifying. Some of them make sense. It was more expensive to hire a woman. They needed chaperones at night. That costs you extra money. There are assignments that there was a strong feeling they shouldn't be asked to do, genteel women. And because of hundreds of years of inculcation, which women themselves had absorbed, there was this sense that women were congenitally unfit to do this work, to do the hardest parts of the work, which is, you know, awful, but I think strongly felt. Women's sphere was home, family, church, and such as that. And this was stepping out of the role that, you know, God intended.
So in an ironic twist, Nellie's article about prejudice against female journalists puts her on the map as a female journalist. And it goes viral, or at least the 19th century equivalent of viral.
The article gets enormous attention and it gets reprinted all over the country, establishing her so that she actually can get into an editor's office and pitch ideas. It's interesting also that in her interviews, she learns a really important journalistic fact that beyond a gender, the big currency is big ideas.
And my word was Nellie Bly cooking up an idea. She lands in the office of an editor. Somebody by the name of Joseph Pulitzer. And if that name sounds familiar, yes, it is the guy that the Pulitzer Prize is named after.
That's the one.
So what was his reputation like at the time?
So his reputation was somebody who was very successful. He had started a paper in St. Louis, then he goes to New York, and then there are Pulitzer papers, you know, in time all over the country. He was considered brilliant.
About a month before Nellie's article went national, there were these stories doing the rounds about untoward things happening to patients and nurses at what they used to refer to as the insane asylum on Blackwell's Island. And of course, Nellie wanted to investigate. The problem is, she knew that if she went in as a journalist and asked questions, everything would be cleaned up, they'd be on all their best behaviour, and she'd never see the reality of the place. So how does she get to see what's really going on? This is the plan. Get admitted as a patient. She has this idea to fake insanity, get inside, observe, take notes, mentally, obviously, and then crucially, get out again.
They decide she's going to spend about 10 days there. And first they quash her legally. They go to the district attorney, because just think about it. What she's doing is illegal. I mean, you're taking a bed from someone who needs a bed. You're faking an illness that you don't have. A lot of reasons for why it could really get you put in jail. So they get her quashed legally so that this is being done in the public interest and the DA goes along with it.
So they've got their plan. They've got legal clearance. Now, they just have to get in there.
So how is she going to do this? She's 21 years old. She is a very well-dressed, pretty little thing. I mean, not beautiful, but she's got this million-dollar smile and a tiny little wasp waist. And she's, you know, kind of special looking. So she practices in the mirror what she thinks insanity might look like, making faces, looking wan, looking distant, looking off. And she trots down to a boarding house in what is now the East Village and signs up to spend the night and starts complaining loudly about her missing trunks, but in a way that's super irritating, you know, just over and over again. She won't go to sleep. She sits up in the parlor, muttering about her trunks, acting really a little menacing to the people who are there and disturbing. And so the assistant matron goes and gets the cops to take her away, which is, of course, what she wanted to have happen. They take her first to police court, where they decide something's really off here. She's using a Spanish accent. This is
what?
From her time in Mexico.
Oh,
she can, like,
God,
pull that off a little. She's a bit of an actress.
Oh, my God.
And she's calling herself Nellie Moreno, you know, which means brown, close enough to Nellie Bly that they can figure out who she is.
So once she gets there, what actually happens to her? She's constructed this complicated character and series of circumstances to allow her to go undercover. What faces her once she's on the inside?
Exactly what faces every woman being admitted to this icky facility. So there's a series of questions. There's an examination by a doctor. She's immediately sent for a bath. Would you like me to read that little segment?
I'm almost afraid to say yes, but yes.
Okay. The water was ice cold, and I began to protest. I begged, at least, that the patients be made to go away, but was ordered to shut up. The crazy woman began to scrub me. I can find no other words that will express it but scrubbing. Rub, 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 went the old woman, chattering to herself. My teeth chattered and my limbs were goose-fleshed and blue with cold. Suddenly, I got, one after the other, three buckets of water over my head, ice cold water too, into my eyes, my ears, my nose, and my mouth. I think I experienced some of the sensation of a drowning person as they dragged me, gasping, shivering, and quaking from the tub. For once, I did look insane.
That is incredible. And I think one of the things that I find most remarkable about this story is once she's on the inside, there's obviously this perception throughout the city that this is where the worst of the worst go. Everybody inside there has what we would now term as severe mental illness. But Brooke, actually, in reality, once she gets in there, she realizes that that's not quite the whole story with these women, is it?
Some of the women are foreign and don't speak English and have been unable to express themselves clearly, probably with some emotion that made them seem off. There are some who are heirs of important fortunes, or even not important fortunes, whose brothers or sisters or cousins want to get them put away so they don't inherit. There are some like that. In addition to some women who really are quite ill. So she finds a mix of these things, which is pretty interesting. Of course, she can't take notes. So she's, you know, doing everything very surreptitiously to remember what she's seen. And then she discovers, you know, just abuses in the structure of the hospital. Like, there was not one lock that locked and opened all the doors. They all were locked individually. So imagine if there were a fire or something like that, how hard it would be to get everybody evacuated. You know, things like that.
What Nellie sees and experiences inside that asylum is confronting. It is overcrowded. It's freezing and filthy. The women, they are abused. The food is revolting. But Nellie, unlike these other women she's surrounded by, she has a way out of this place. She's only meant to be here for 10 days. But she looks around at these women and realises they could be there for the rest of their lives. And that is when the thought occurs to her. What if they never come back for me? What if I'm stuck in here? Luckily, that doesn't happen. The paper sticks to their word and they come to get her out.
They send an attorney and they send the illustrator who illustrated most of her work, because her work would appear with these beautiful line drawings. And they say that they're relatives and they're willing to look after her, and they get her released.
Nellie's expose is published in the paper and it makes quite the splash.
It runs over two successive Sundays, like a whole page and then a front of the feature section, which is, you know, super big deal. And everybody's reading. And then, of course, there's this whole reprint structure where people are reprinting stories all over the country. This is just hugely interesting and establishes her instantaneously as a major figure in the field, which is just unheard of. I mean, people build a career for years to have that kind of moment. Here she's been a journalist for barely 2 years, and this is her first story in New York. I mean, it's just so enviable. You can see why everybody just hated her guts, and they did. They just hated her, especially the other women. Oh my God, hated her. So she, you know, when you look at the industry journals, which I spent a lot of time with, other women are being celebrated for doing almost nothing. And, you know, they're just not talking about Nellie Bly, or they're saying something evil. The jealousy is just rampant.
Nellie went into this asylum in the first place to tell the story of these women and how they were being treated. Did the story actually change things for them?
After she gets out, after her stories are published, there is outcry about this mistreatment that no one has really quite understood till now. There have been intimations in the paper, but nothing so authoritative as an eyewitness saying, I saw this, I was there, you can believe me. There is a grand jury investigation, there is a tour. Some things have been cleaned up, of course, because as soon as this has appeared, you know, people get fired, things happen. But nobody doubted her. And it was clear how dank the facility was, how little was being offered to people. They're sitting on a bench all day outside. I mean, they're offered almost no recreation. Pretty horrible. But I think she did bring attention for the first time to a really important issue.
Nellie's expose put a spotlight not just on the treatment of patients, but the conditions they lived in. And suddenly, funding went up. Blackwell's Asylum got an extra $1.6 million in today's money. But 7 years after the expose, they shut the whole thing down.
Journalism at its absolute best is when not only you have exposed a wrong, but you have put people in a position of power to be willing to act to change what's happening. So there isn't more than that. That is everything. And she has achieved this at 22 years old.
22?
Yep.
Wow. How did she take to the fame?
She loved it, of course, because she just has a massive ego. I mean, what a personality. But she's in love with herself. She has incredible confidence. She thinks she can do anything with her smile and her wasp waist, as I mentioned. I mean, she's really big on those two things. You read about them in many stories. You're reading her work and you're going, oh my God, how can she say these things? I think I'm going to throw up. And yet you still read. You know, it's just like watching a train wreck or something. You just have to keep going.
So Nellie has now got a permanent job at The World. She went on to publish a book called 10 Days in a Madhouse. Can I just say, Anybody working in journalism even today knows that a stable job and a book deal, these are very coveted things. She is absolutely killing it, even by today's standards. However, this is really interesting thing that happens. The investigation and her subsequent fame, it actually sparked a reporting movement called stunt girl journalism.
These women flower across the country. Every paper of any size has a Polly Pry or a Dorothy Dare or a, you know, somebody with an alliterative name who's doing these sorts of things. One of the great distinctions between Nellie and many of the others, not all, but many, is that she is always having a social agenda. She is always looking at something that has to do with representing the unvoiced or correcting a wrong or exposing a fraud. She's always got a social action involved. It's not just, oh, let me stand outside the union club selling flowers and see how many men solicit me, or let me put on this bulletproof vest and let people shoot at me, or let me go up in a balloon or down in a diving bell. That is not what she does, though many others do.
The amazing thing is, Nellie is far from a one-hit wonder, and she goes on to do some wild stories.
Almost every week, Nellie is doing another stunt. She has a couple in the period that are really big, some that are smaller but, you know, effective, like she tries to expose the baby buying trade by posing as someone wanting to buy a baby. She goes to prison to see if matrons are abusing prisoners. She becomes a prisoner. You know, she does things like that that are kind of one-hit wonders, you know, nothing so spectacular but eminently readable. And then a really big one is she goes to Albany posing as a woman who wants to bribe a lobbyist, and she bribes him. And that's huge. She runs the guy out of town. This is another really big one where there's real impact. Week after week, there's another Nellie expose.
Then she turns her attention to a story that has taken the world by storm. And it is quite literally a story.
People have the idea of trying to best the fictional record of Phileas Fogg and Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. Like, can you do better than that? You know, can you go faster?
And so the newspaper that Nellie works for, The World, they want to send a guy on this assignment.
And Nellie, who now is, you know, really standing tall in her britches, says, well, if you do that, I'm going to do it for someone else and I'm going to beat him. So The World relents. They let her go. In a day and a half, she gets a traveling cloak made. She buys this leather bag. She takes a change of underwear, like one dress she rolls up in there, and that's all she has. So she gets ready to go. She takes off on a steamship. The World is covering it day by day, as is every paper in the country, because it's like a big deal. And then she gets to California. She makes it across the Rockies. There's an avalanche. I mean, all kinds of things happen. And she does it in 72 days and some hours, which is, you know, amazing. So what happens? Of course, this has, you know, been fabulous for circulation. It's a big deal. Pulitzer is supposed to give her a bonus. He's supposed to have a medal struck in her honor.
Spoiler alert, he doesn't give her a bonus. And there is no medal.
And she is full of herself and furious. She leaves The World in a huff because she's just not going to be treated that way.
Why do you think Nellie Bly has lodged herself so deeply in the public imagination? And I guess perhaps more specifically, your imagination.
Well, mine, because she, you know, she's the reason I became a journalist, as is true for many. She has had that impact on a lot of people. You read this story and you think, wow, I could do that. You know, because she's nobody. She's a girl from nowhere. She's a girl without money, without education. She's not a genius. Nellie is every woman. She's every girl. So the ability to see yourself in that situation is much more possible.
So after all of her exposés, her hard work, and now having returned from this incredible adventure, Nellie Bly forged an incredible legacy. And she did it all in about 2.5 years.
I mean, how many journalists do you know who worked for 2.5 years who we're talking about all these centuries later? It's remarkable. She's just really quite something.
Brooke Kroger is a journalist and emeritus professor at New York University. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf, and the sound engineer was Angie Grant. As always, the show is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. And if you don't already, maybe you're listening to the show for the first time, please like, subscribe, follow the show. Of course, if you do want to get in touch with us with your own story, you should, which is exactly what Michael from Perth did. So Michael from Perth wrote in, suggested Nellie Bly's story, and here, friends, we are with a brand new episode. If you've got a story, shoot us an email, noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. And I am Mark Fennell, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.